It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. FoxNewsPodcast.com will show you all of the different podcasts that are available, and I hope that you'll check it out. I hope you also subscribe and rate and review this one. Today, I'm going to be talking with Dave Marcus. He is a columnist for the New York Post and the author of a new book, Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. He has been, until recently, the New York correspondent for The Federalist. Dave is someone who has a keen mind and insight on a number of different areas of American life that is really unique and offers a perspective that we don't always get on the right. His book has been an enormous success thus far. It's number 2 right now on Amazon in the politics section, and it's in the top 10 on all of Amazon. I hope that you'll check out his book as well. Again, that's Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. Dave Marcus, coming up next.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Dave Marcus, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Always my pleasure.
I want to talk to you about your book, obviously. But first, I want to get your perspective on someone else. I use a stack of books to position my microphone every day, and it seems appropriate that the one that's on the top here that I'm looking at has this black and white visage of a tough-looking politician. It's called American Crisis, and it's by Andrew Cuomo. How do you think this book and the work of Andrew Cuomo during the pandemic will be considered in future years?
That's a really interesting and incredibly complicated question. Clearly, I mean, my own opinion and the opinion of many other people in New York and around the country is that he should really be remembered as one of the great villains of this crisis, in part because of mistakes that he made, most notably the deadly mistakes that he made with regard to putting infected patients in nursing homes. But then also for a really remarkable combination of hubris and like refusal to apologize or acknowledge that he had done anything wrong. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, I think we now know from Letitia James's report that the sort of obfuscation of the real numbers was either happening while he was writing the book or right around that time. So that's really the biggest takeaway for me is that the lionization of Andrew Cuomo was not a situation where like he was doing a great job until he stopped doing a great job. Mm. He was never doing a great job. He was always doing an awful job. And the media chose to turn him into this anti-Donald Trump. And look, I'm nervous that's what history will remember, is the lies and not the truth.
Mm-hmm. The problem that I have is that I think there were so many smart people at the time, and I think regardless of their personal ideology, who actually did get the impression he was doing a good job. I remember people who were right of center even saying, I wish it seems to me like if you look closer, Cuomo and Trump are actually saying similar things, and I just wish that Trump would say them more like Cuomo or things along those lines. And I was like, well, I'm not sure about that, but I mean, I guess. And it just seemed to be such an example of how the Trump derangement syndrome completely adjusted the normal things you would expect from a media that has generally been skeptical in prior years of politicians, certainly more of Republicans than of Democrats, but at least enough to ask some tough questions. Why do we now live in this climate where it really did take Trump losing to finally ask some questions about the performance of Andrew Cuomo, Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom and others?
Well, look, I mean, there is some truth to the fact that not only Andrew Cuomo, but also Dr. Anthony Fauci and Trump were saying a lot of the same things, especially early on. I think in the earliest weeks of the pandemic, the media was trying really hard to make it Trump versus Fauci, Trump versus Cuomo, Trump versus Newsom, right? And if you recall, there was like a press conference early on that Newsom gave where he was like, no, Trump's giving me what I need. Like, this is good. And man, CNN did not want to hear it, right? that was not the copy they were looking for. And so I do think that these artificial disagreements started to take hold, and then those actors started playing their parts a little bit and sort of attacking each other. And there was the politicization, but ultimately I think it wasn't politicization, it was polarization, right? Mm-hmm. I'm of the opinion that people say, oh, you know, politics got in the way of our response. I think there wasn't enough politics, right? We all said, this doesn't have to do with politics, just follow the science. But unemployment and education and mental health and all of these side effects of dealing with COVID, they're all political questions, and they're all questions that should be dealt with by the body politic.
You know, that's such a good point, Dave, because in a sense, what you had was scared politicians outsourcing these decisions under the guise of, we're just going to follow the science, as opposed to making tough choices themselves, which is a classic and recurring feature of bureaucratic governance versus elected governance, you know, where, well, one of us has to go back in front of the voters in 2 years or 4 years. And so I'm going to outsource this decision to someone who doesn't have to. So then I can just complain about what they're doing, as opposed to actually having to make a tough choice myself. That's something that we've seen in other areas. I mean, it's obviously that's basically the entire basis of Obamacare. But when it comes to the decisions that happen within a pandemic, those have an outsized effect on the people who are living under the thumb of these various bureaucracies. And, you know, you mentioned a public schooling and education. It seems to me that nowhere more than that are we going to see the downstream effects of the choices that were not made by our elected representatives, but instead outsourced, affecting the lives of children for, you know, perhaps the next several decades of their life, if not the rest of their life.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. It reminded me of this moment. This is probably like 15 years ago on The Simpsons. There's the episode where Homer goes to work for like the Bond villain. And like the Bond villain is on like a conference call with the United Nations, and he's threatening to blow off New York or something, right? And somebody, one of the guys in the United Nations is like, you know, I don't know, like maybe he won't do it. And someone gravely says, well, we can't take that chance. And one guy goes, you always say that. I want to take a chance. you
know, like, voiced by Albert Brooks, by the way.
Was it? Yeah, you know, yes, I want to take a chance. Yes. Like, why can't we? You know, just this once. And that's sort of, you know, that was sort of the mentality of like, we got into this rut of like, well, Fauci says that. It was like, okay, that's what we have to do. And one of the big problems, so of course, all these state legislatures, as you say, just punted the football, right? They were just like, hey, governor, here's all the power. Have it for as long as you want. We're washing our hands of this. And one of the huge problems with that is that governors don't do constituent services.
Yeah.
If you have an issue, right, if you can't open your business, if there's a problem going on in your neighborhood, you don't get 500 people together and go to the state capitol and try to tell the governor about it. You go out on the sidewalk in front of your state assemblyman's office, and that gets some attention, right? That's your conduit into affecting political power. When for a year, in what I, as far as I've been able to find, is a completely unprecedented fashion, state legislatures just stopped functioning. The people lost their voice utterly and completely.
You know, Dave, you do this work in Charade of going back through the different experiences and moments that happened during this pandemic, and you outline them for us. One of the things that I think we have to avoid is the urge to look away. You know, I think there is that really is a psychological phenomenon coming out of this horrible experience for Americans. It's just like, oh, can we please just move on? And from my perspective, that's a real error, because we learned a lot of things during this, and we learned a lot of bad things about, you know, perhaps elements of our, you know, political community and neighborhood environments that that were, you know, sort of under the surface all along, but came out during this. What are some of the key lessons you think that we need to really learn going over the past year and a half about ourselves, about the country, and about the way that we ought to think about things moving forward?
I mean, look, I think the biggest one is really what I just said, that we can't substitute the American people through their elected representatives making their own choices for a panel of experts appointed by governors or a president, because, you know, they'll find all kinds of reasons to do that, whether it's climate change or racism or whatever it is. You know, but I think you're right about not looking back, but I think it's even a little more complicated than that. It's not just that it might be painful to look back, right? Like, I took that into account in really trying to make, it's going to sound strange, but make the pieces as much sort of fun as I could, because there were light moments in all of this. There have to be. We're human beings. I think part of the problem with looking back on it is that time was so meaningless for at least a period of a few months, and everything was happening in such strange and fast and unprecedented ways that we don't remember. So in writing the book, things kept popping up from just a month or two ago. And I was like, oh yeah. You know, like every couple of weeks, I'll just tweet out the phrase, don't touch your face. Like, just don't touch your face. Because every day that goes by, the absolute absurdity of that becomes clearer and clearer. But man, that was a real thing, right? It was a real thing for like 2 weeks where people were like, okay, my hand is dangerous. Don't let it touch my face. And I think that we do need to go back through that, through the haircuts, through the, you know, through all of these little things, through Tiger King, you know, whatever it was, we all went through the same stuff and remember it. And I think most of us do when we do that kind of say, oh, right, I forgot about that. Because it was such a bizarre time for so many people in their lives.
The bizarre nature of it is something that you lived through, because you stayed in New York for almost the entire pandemic. Tell me a little bit about it, your personal experience of it, and what you saw being in New York City in the epicenter of this. I, as you know, and my wife and a lot of people that we know who lived in New York, or, you know, spent most of their time in New York, got out of the city. You know, they fled to, you know, various different places, both disclosed and undisclosed, and basically said, yeah, we don't want to live through this in, you know, a city where, you know, your apartment is basically the place you sleep. And most of the time you live, you're outside and or you're going to restaurants or bars or work or the like. You're not, you know, living in your apartment the way that people do, because it's a shoebox. Tell me a little bit about the things that you saw and the different ways that people approached that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think the overwhelming sensation for most people who stayed was that it was lonely, you know. My son and his mom had gone down, thankfully, like to the Jersey Shore to get him out of the city, because it was pretty dark. I mean, especially for that first month, it was eerily quiet. And the only thing that really pierced the quiet were these sirens that you would hear everywhere. So that was strange. You were seeing not only images of trucks with body bags, but then being, you know, then beginning to see like images of bread lines like you hadn't seen, you know, since the 1930s. So I would say for that first month, it was scary and weird and creepy. And that's another one of those things that's kind of hard to remember, because by the time I started writing this book, it was about this time last year. And we were basically through that worst, that really bad period into, and it was summer. You could go outside. Streets were still pretty empty, but you could tell stuff was coming back to life. And when I would go back and look at my notes from mid-March to mid-April, they were dark. And I really had to remind myself of how dark that was. So, and New York got dark again in the winter when the restaurants got shut down again. And that was arguably worse back in December, because then it was freezing out. And then we really couldn't do anything except sit in our apartments. So, I think New York clearly got the worst of it. But, and unfortunately, and this is a very early piece that I wrote, the first one that I took a lot of heat for, was a piece that said, we can't treat the rest of the country like New York.
Mm-hmm.
Which in far too many cases, you know, we did. But as with almost any story, like New York became the national epicenter of the story. And we did kind of pretend like the whole country was New York when, you know, we all know it's not.
So I want to go back to something, and this is going to be, I will say, a little hubristic of me, but I wrote a piece on March 20th of last year, called Predictions: What Will America Look Like After the Wuhan Coronavirus? Of course, obviously, I said that before I knew that apparently that's now a hate crime. And I ran through, basically, it was kind of a response to a podcast by Tyler Cowen and Russ Roberts, obviously two economists and very brilliant people who were sort of looking at this. And it's funny because I didn't even realize this, but in the first paragraph, I predict that between 250 and 400,000 Americans will probably die in the coming year from this.
Mm-hmm.
And which is
pretty close.
Pretty close. So anyway, they sort of ran through a bunch of different predictions that they were making. And some of the predictions were that we would see the death of college as we know it. Higher ed would die, that we would see in-person events will be rare, but when they are, they will be more intense and defiant. I said that, I actually was, here's a good line. I do expect gyms to be very much in demand as people attempt to work off their inevitable weight gain over sustained periods of isolation, unless you got a Peloton for Christmas. Okay. That one was definitely right. so, it was just sort of looking at like, what will things be like after we get through this? One of the things that I said, was that we would probably experience a rise in nationalism, a skepticism toward China, anti-refugee attitudes increasing, things like that. I'm not sure if that's turned out to be true, but basically the predictions that I had were really that they would see an increase in objection to public schooling and to higher education as a whole. Talk to me a little bit about the way that the schooling and education portion of this played out, because I think that was the element that should have been obvious was going to become a point of tension. And yet a lot of people seem to be surprised at the degree to which it became central to this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, your predictions were a lot better than mine, as I sort of outlined on the book in terms of, like, you know, those of us at the Federalist or the people that I was talking to at the New York Post, like, I was like the last person who admitted that this was actually going to be a problem, right? Like, I was literally like that meme of the guy like sipping tea in the house on fire, like, this is fine. I didn't, you know, like Chris Bedford and Molly Hemingway kept saying, you know, guys, this could be a thing. I'm like, ah, come on, really? It's a virus. What's going to happen? And yeah, you know, part of that, I think, you know, in terms of the schooling, you know, I can't remember if it was for us or for the Post. I think it was for us because I think Carol Markowitz wrote the one for the Post. But there was a flurry of pieces the weekend before schools closed being like, hey, de Blasio, stop being an idiot. Like, we haven't even used any snow days yet. Just close the schools for, like, you know, a week. Let us assess what the problem is and then we go back. That made a lot of sense to me at the time. In retrospect, I understand, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I understand that maybe de Blasio was right and I was wrong about that. The reason being that, and through some people that I spoke to in city government, I feel like this is accurate. de Blasio kind of understood that once he pulled the trigger on closing the schools, the teachers' unions were not going to let him open them back up. Right? Because once he said, this is enough of a problem where I'm going to close school for a week to see where we are was never going to be enough for Randy Weingarten and the teachers' union. And we saw that play out throughout the entire year, where they were just absolutely adamant, you know, you're trying to kill us, you know, this is dangerous. Of course we can't have in-person school. And it really wasn't until the political and polling tide started to change on that, that you had these absurd gestures of, I guess it was last month when Biden and Weingarten both announced that they were going to launch a crusade to have in-person learning. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you're the only people who were against it. Like, you know, that's like launching a crusade against the Vatican. I mean, like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, so they got that. I'm hopeful. You know, people have asked me, you know, throughout this, even before the book, if I think there's any silver lining. And the one potential silver lining that I see is that I think the teachers' unions learned a lesson about how far they can go. And I think you see that. I actually think it's very related to what we're seeing in terms of critical race theory right now. That this stuff about open the schools, get the mask off my kid, kind of opened a floodgate of parents being like, wait a minute, I can go to these school board meetings.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's actually been inspiring to me, because I feel like that's an element of Americans that is, you know, when it relates to your kid, you're far less docile. You know, you won't necessarily go along with these things. Talk to me a little bit about the reflections that you have about the experience of Dr. Fauci as the unquestionable saint, and then the appearance of Scott Atlas as being the person who has the audacity to question him.
Yeah, you know, I'm worried that some readers are going to be disappointed, because I'm not really all that hard on Fauci in the book, in large part because I finished the book right around the end of the election. So that's sort of chronologically, the book takes us from like January of 2020 to like mid-November of 2020. And honestly, I think a lot of the really egregious Fauci stuff didn't happen or didn't become completely clear until this year.
Yes.
And specifically with the turning of the administration, where he felt a little more emboldened to, I'm just going to say it, lie, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the first one that was really off the charts was moving the goal on how many people what percentage had to be vaccinated.
Yeah.
And then flat out saying to us, oh, that's not based on any science. That's based on what I think will, you know, manufacture the behavior in the American people that I want from them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, a little bit before that, towards the end of the election, you saw Atlas come on the scene as also, and not just Atlas, like also, you know, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and you know, everyone who was involved in the Great Barrington Declaration. And it started to become clear that this thing we had been told was a concrete, solid scientific consensus was anything but. And I remember the morning that Twitter blocked Scott Atlas's tweet, because I wrote that story for us. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked. I mean, I really, because I looked deeply into it. I looked at all of the things that he was citing in his tweet, and it was all peer reviewed. It was all, there was no wrong fact in there. And they just took it down because they didn't like it. And that was a huge wake-up call, not just in terms of that narrative of setting up heroes and villains, but then big tech putting its thumb on the scale so that the villain can't even defend himself.
Yeah. You know, I know that you are someone who has moved a bit on these big tech issues over the course of the past couple of years. And now I think you recognize the threat that they represent to American freedom and to free expression, freedom of thought. I don't know if you have a solution, but it does seem to me that one of the things that comes out of this pandemic is a greater awareness on the part of the average human about this. And I'll give you an example that is very recent. Jon Stewart goes on Stephen Colbert, and he gives a rant about the Wuhan coronavirus lab, and you know that clearly Colbert is trying to kind of not shout down, but just like sort of hem in. It's almost like this is the thing, and I think Andrew Schultz made this point, this is the thing we joke about backstage, and now you're doing it on TV, you know. And Stewart's rant goes viral. You know, conservatives love it. Liberals really can't object to it. Everyone knows that it's true. And the thing that really came out of that, though, was if he had said that in a Facebook post 3 weeks earlier, it would have been banned, or it would have been, you know, restrained. It would have, you know, put in lockdown. You know, he would have been in the same category as QAnon and conspiracy theorists and the like. Instead, him saying this very logical thing that has enormous, you know, factual support. We don't know 100% whether it's true or not, but we do know there's a strong argument for it. Him saying this on CBS, on national TV, goes viral because so many people agree with it. To me, that's a perfect reflection of how ridiculous these restrictions really are. You know, that Facebook can sort of say, hey, talking about the Wuhan lab leak theory, that's a conspiracy theory that we're going to either, you know, curtail, silence, or we're going to ban you for. And then just arbitrarily, a few weeks later, they say, well, new information has come to light, you know, in the Lebowski fashion. So to me, this whole experience was a reflection on how outsized the power of these tech entities are to silence the kind of conversation that we think ought to happen in incidents like this, where scientists, intelligent experts, you know, and people are sharing ideas across these platforms and eventually coming to some conclusions that can actually be helpful to people.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Stewart Colbert exchange was deeply fascinating in a number of ways. I mean, for one thing, you know, it was interesting. You corrected yourself from saying shouted down to whatever it was that Colbert's reaction was. Colbert's reaction was amazing because he had no idea what to do. He just had no idea what to do. The Stewart's bit was working, right? He was getting laughs. It made sense. And he just kind of sat there with his coffee cup with no idea what to do, which is, you know, how CNN has been sitting there for 6 months as, as, you know, it didn't turn out that DeSantis engaged in human sacrifice. what was also telling was what Stewart was really joking about was not the lab leak itself, right? Stewart's joke was based in this idea of, huh, okay, this laboratory is called the Coronavirus Research Laboratory. Oh, and there just happens to be a coronavirus going around. Right? That was his joke. And what that joke really spoke to was the idea that the American people were told to stop using their common sense for a year, right? This is science. Common sense has nothing to do with it, right? And so you're not a scientist. If you think the idea of not touching your face is like ridiculous, well, it probably seems that way to you. Or wiping down your groceries. It probably seems that way to you. But that's because you're not a scientist. So, right? And that was, I always, throughout the pandemic, I kept thinking of that moment in Ghostbusters where Bill Murray like looks at somebody and goes, back off, man, I'm a scientist. You know, like that was like our whole experience. Like, oh yeah, you're a guy's a scientist. Right? What are you going to do? You know? Like, take your pants off. No, I'm a scientist. Okay. You know? Yeah, and that's what happened.
It's just one of the other things that was amazing about this whole experience in terms of the online aspect of it was you would have people banned, restrained, you know, canceled simply for questioning things that were put out into the public as being, you know, various aspects of advice. You know, for instance, a perfect example of this is the conversation around masks. Now, I am entirely of the mind that you can probably prove that masking up when using a medical N95 you know, probably did make some kind of difference. You know, I think that there is enough proof about that. But when it came to basically, you know, shoving a bandana around your face, or, you know, putting these dirty cloth masks over our faces. I mean, there's even a report out this week about, you know, the amount of germs that are being caught in cloth masks that you put on your kids over and over and again. The point is that there's a different level of usefulness for this. Now, I know that we reported, and many other outlets reported on this, that basically, you know, hey, if you're not using these high quality medical ones, you might as well not be using one at all. It doesn't really matter, you know, and that became a huge fight with these social media platforms, with Twitter and with Facebook and the like. And then the Wall Street Journal, with I believe a piece by Scott Gottlieb, you know, said not all masks are equal, you know, and they had a piece that ran, you know, in their opinion section, but it was basically saying the exact same things that everyone had been saying online for like a month. And they were unwilling to ban that piece because it came from the Wall Street Journal. So we have reached a point where basically the entity that is actually writing the argument depends on whether it gets canceled or not. And if it's in a different outlet, then they're more reluctant to cancel it. The same thing happens with, you know, basically if something is in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or the Washington Post, then these social media platforms are far more reluctant to cancel it, even if it's saying the exact same thing that is being said in other outlets. That to me was a pretty disturbing experience to observe during all of this, and it happened repeatedly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know this from experience, but it seems to me like it's probably like rude to cancel the person who you were in a frat with at Yale. You know, like that's probably just like not behavior that the people who are, you know, running things in Silicon Valley and their buddies at the, not, I don't want to drag the Wall Street Journal, but you understand what I'm saying.
No, it's true.
There is this, you know, that crosses a line for them somehow. And I think part of what I realized during this was that, and I realized it relatively early on, was that it was pointless to negotiate with the big tech rules, because they weren't rules. There were no guidelines to follow. It was just this sort of like arbitrary, like, here's where the progressive zeitgeist is on this, and if you run afoul of it, like, we're taking it down. And that was when, and it's interesting, man, because this goes much deeper than just the pandemic. I think this is stuff that I've been thinking about in terms of the conservative movement in general. Is that you can't negotiate anymore. You have to go really big. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote the cover piece for the New York Post in May, it wasn't, you know, the cover didn't say, let's be sensible about these restrictions. It says it needs to end now. Mm-hmm. And I said, open the whole city right now, the whole thing. Now, did I think there was a chance in hell that the whole city was going to open? Of course not. But I had grown so sick and tired of like playing this small ball where, like, even when I, you know, even when I tried to like make a sacrifice from my side, it was pointless and it didn't matter. You know, I think we see that in the general question of like big tech. And I do think that central orthodoxy of conservatism of keep the government out of it, you know, small government, limited government, is incredibly challenged by big tech and their power, because mm-hmm. we might be at a point where the only thing that can stand up to that are the levers of government power. And if that's true, then conservatives need to rethink some things.
So let's talk about that, because it's another aspect of your work separate from the book that is very interesting. You had a great piece at Fox on kind of the outlines of the direction of the right in the future. Tell me a little bit about how you see that landscape, because it's clearly undergoing a change that involves both a generational shift and a priority shift along a lot of different lines. So talk to me about some of the developments that you find interesting in that space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I told you this before, but one of the things that I've thought about a lot is a story that you told about, I think you were at South by Southwest, mm-hmm. might have been Aspen, it was one of those, right? And you were on a panel with, what was it? I think it was Bill Kristol and Brett Stevens. Was Amanda Carpenter there?
Yeah. It was like, oh, it was Texas Tribune. Yeah. Yes.
Texas
yeah.
Tribune, right. And the first point that you made when it came to you to make opening remarks is you said something along the lines of, this is a panel on the future of conservatism. We have five people on stage. None of us voted for Trump.
Yeah. Yep.
And I never forgot that. And I was like, boy, that's a thing. Right. And then I ended up taking these trips, driving back and forth across the country, learning about the people who were voting for Trump and understanding how poorly they were being represented by politicians and by the media and stuff like that. And so next month, I'll be moderating a panel at CPAC about the future of conservatism. And I'm pretty sure that everyone on that stage will have voted for Trump in 2020, or at least have been supportive, right? Mm-hmm. So that sort of represents the change. But the broadest things that I see is a shift away to something that is closer to Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan, and the Reform Party in terms of protectionism and in terms of getting out of trade deals from Buchanan, really, in terms of fighting the culture war, which clearly the Bush era neoliberal conservatives had no interest in. Mm-hmm. And I think that Trump brought the Republican Party and the conservative movement more into that direction. And it doesn't matter how many times CNN and MSNBC put Never Trumpers on TV. They don't represent any significant constituency. And so, you know, right now, I think the project is to figure out what this new movement is going to represent, because there are some internal conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what those conflicts are from your perspective.
I think there's a few potential ones. You know, big tech is one of them, right? And I think broadly, everyone on the new right agrees big tech is a problem. When you drill down to the question of how much government power are you willing to use to mitigate the problem, I think there are still people who aren't exactly Josh Hawley or Ron DeSantis on this, who are still skeptical of government power. I think immigration's another one. And again, there's broad agreement that we have to have a wall, we have to have a firm border, we can't have illegal immigration, right? Everyone on the new right agrees with that. But when you then talk about what should legal immigration look like, even Trump himself was a little bit all over the map on that, right? Like sometimes it seemed like he was saying, we love immigration, we just want to make sure they're not criminals and that they're able to get a job and stuff. Sometimes he was a little closer to the Michael Anton line of, we need to be careful about the culture. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely another one where I think there are some kinks to work out in terms of what the future looks like.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is going to be an interesting challenge and certainly is going to require some new leadership. In terms of the generational shift, we obviously are moving away from a political class in Washington that has been made up of people in their 70s and 80s to people who are going to be, frankly, from your generation of Gen X. What does that mean in terms of understanding this particular moment? You know, Ron DeSantis is Gen X. I guess Hawley is technically an elder millennial. He's like maybe a first year millennial or something like that. But, you know, probably the next, you know, crew of people who are going to be running for president on the Republican side, they're probably all going to be Gen Xers. What can we expect from that element within the political landscape?
Well, you know the answer to that. I mean, they're Gen Xers, so there's going to be like really wonderful and fascinating ideas and great parties, and very little will actually get done.
That's classic. Yes,
you know,
yes.
I do think that's what you can expect from the Gen Xers. And there's not that many of us. So I do think that whereas we had boomer presidents for a couple decades, that Gen X moment of political power, I think, is going to be much shorter. And so I do think that this is ultimately going to be much more a story about millennials and Gen Z, who I think, for example, do take a different view of things like, you know, big tech. I think that the younger kids are already starting to roll their eyes a little bit at the shibboleths of millennials on race and on stuff like that. I've always thought of Gen X a little bit like that silent generation that gave us like the Beats, that sort of came of age in the 50s and stuff. They were much more influential than they were powerful. And I think you'll see some of that play out here. But yeah, I mean, the only other thing that I'd add to that is that progressivism, which has now replaced liberalism, is so sort of stale and cookie cutter that the opportunity has existed for a while now for conservatism to be the counterculture. And we see some success in that, right? I think we see some podcasters and YouTube people, for example, who we think of as right-oriented at least, who really have an enormous amount of sway and power in new media and stuff, because they're frankly just way more interesting than repeating the same lines about, I tweeted this thing today where I was like, you know, racist infrastructure is a public health crisis that, you know, through climate change is going to destroy the world in 10 years. And that's it, right? It's some variation on that. So yeah, I think the kids are all right.
Dave Marcus, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dave Marcus. I wanted to talk about another person who is attracting attention from the various internet scolds and the like, given his coverage of the entire pandemic process, coming out of it and more. And that's Brett Weinstein. The conversation around him is probably one that you are at least somewhat familiar with. He's the Evergreen State College professor who was forced out of that university when he had the audacity to stand up to a number of students who were accusing him of being a racist. Matt Taibbi, who I've made reference to on this podcast before, has a lengthy piece on his Substack that ran on June the 19th. You can find it at taibbi.substack.com. That's taibbi.substack.com. Meet the Censored is the name of this piece. And I really highly recommend it to you because I think it's very much an image of the nation as it's becoming. He writes in part, Weinstein was a Bernie Sanders supporter who described his politics as unabashedly liberal, even leftist. Like many, he'd grown up seeped in the imagery of 60s protest culture, probably imagined himself on its side, and therefore thought he could find solidarity with protesters. He didn't realize that he was the canary in a coal mine of a new movement that understood free speech as a stalking horse for the exercise of institutional power. When Weinstein opened his mouth to defend himself, what the crowd heard was him attempting to exercise authority, and they exercised theirs back. They'd won over Evergreen's new president, George Bridges, who refused to intercede in Weinstein's behalf, and later even asked college police to stand down when protesters began stopping traffic and searching cars for someone, presumably Weinstein. The police told Weinstein they couldn't guarantee his safety, and ultimately he was in fact forced to resign. Frequently portrayed as the involuntary protagonist of the first of a series of campus free speech crises, in fact, Weinstein was one of the first to understand that a rollback of free speech in cases like his was incidental to the larger aims of the movement. What is occurring on college campuses is about power and control. Speech is impeded as a last resort, he told the House Oversight Committee. He described the new movement as like a cult, in which members sincerely believed they were acting to stop oppression, but leaders understood they were simply turning the tables on oppression. They were exercising authority to achieve what may be presented as social justice goals, while the actual end is the authority itself, with the teardown of due process and other protections a critical part of the picture. This committee, he said, should take my tale as cautionary. Fast forward 3 years. Weinstein and his wife, Heather Hying, has become prominent figures in independent media, co-hosting a popular podcast called Dark Horse. Identified in the New York Times as one of the main dramatis persona of the so-called intellectual dark web, a group of heterodox intellectuals not aligned with the traditional right or left, he appeared for a time to find a home on YouTube. Maybe he would never go back to academia, but this seemed a more secure replacement. After all, it's one thing to be dependent on the whims of a college president or even a faculty board, but surely there's a safety in subscriber numbers. Not so fast. As detailed in another of Taibbi's pieces, Why Has Ivermectin Become a Dirty Word?, Weinstein is on the verge of becoming one of the more prominent casualties to a censorship movement that it's hard not to see as part of a wider evergreening of America. He and Hying's two YouTube channels have been hit with multiple warnings for two brands of speech offenses and are on the verge of having their business shut down entirely as a result. YouTube has a three strikes and you're out policy. One offense involves interviews with the likes of Dr. Pierre Corey about the potential benefits of the repurposed drug ivermectin, and the other involves interviews with guests like Dr. Robert Malone, inventor of the mRNA vaccine technology used in the COVID-19 vaccines. One video with Malone this week had 587,331 views before it was shut down. In the years since Weinstein left Evergreen, the American cultural and political establishment has undergone a change in thinking, tracking with the warning Weinstein delivered to Congress. The Trump election inspired a loss of faith in democracy. Charlottesville defamed speech rights. Russiagate was an ongoing argument against due process, with many of the same people who opposed Dick Cheney's spy state suddenly seeing themselves as aligned with the FBI, the NSA, and the CIA in the war on Trump. Weinstein, in his testimony, talked about a movement that targeted the liberal concepts that traditionally bound us together, one being the marketplace of ideas. By 2021, the marketplace of ideas was regularly being portrayed as a trick, a tool for repression designed to conceal the fact that, as the New York Times put it last year, good ideas do not always triumph in a marketplace of ideas. I encourage you to read the entire Taibbi piece. I think it's a very good warning about the kind of experience that we are going through right now in America, and it's only going to get worse. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.